And I just wondered if you could maybe reflect what had happened that Friday, November 22nd, when you're in that, I guess, that news station wagon, and then a couple of days later when you were only supposed to be holding the microphone, and lo and behold, a man steps out and murders the chief suspect of the President of the United States murder. So if you could talk about that.
Sure. Well, of course, our facilities back then were far more primitive than they are today. And I, on the 22nd, was broadcasting the motorcade from Main and Akron in downtown Dallas. And I was delighted to see that such a warm welcome had showed up for Dallas in downtown. It looked as though the entire city had turned out that day, and I was delighted because Dallas had been embarrassed by a couple of really unfortunate incidents in the past in the way of right-wing demonstrators who had really been extremely rude and had spat upon and jeered and heckled Lyndon Johnson and his wife during the campaign of 1960 when they were just trying to move between hotels in downtown Dallas. This was known to us reporters as the mink coat mob. They were junior leaguer type women who were supporters of the Republican Congressman Bruce Alger of Dallas, who was the only Republican congressman from Texas at that time. And that was quite a rarity. And he was a right-wing sort of fellow, and his supporters were extremely rude and vocal. And then 1 month before the assassination, almost to the day, our United Nations Ambassador Adlai Stevenson had honored the city by coming to Dallas to speak on United Nations Day. We were going to broadcast that speech. Well, in fact, we did broadcast his address live. And during that address, there was a terrible demonstration that broke out within the auditorium. And as an example of why I titled my book, When the News Went Live, that day, 1 month before, when the disturbance broke out in the auditorium, we were carrying the speech live. But our director had all of our cameras tilt upward so that they would not be showing the unseemly display in the auditorium. That's a perfect example of the fact that in television, in its early days, and these were its early days, we were broadcasting formal programming. We broadcast public events and sports events. We at KRLD broadcast the Dallas Cowboys, so we had an unusual setup to feed CBS back then, better than most of the television stations in the Dallas-Fort Worth area at that time. And so we were able to set up our mobile facilities as quickly as we could on the day that the president was assassinated. Before that day, we had never used mobile television capabilities to broadcast news from on the scene. Now, of course, with the new technologies that have developed over the decades, it's done all the time. But back in our day, it was difficult to do. There were only two communications satellites aloft at that time, and neither of them was carrying commercial broadcasting at that time. And so it was a matter of microwave relays from station to station, tower to tower, all the way across the United States to both coasts. And soon after the terrible tragedy took place on the 22nd, we were hooked up directly to New York City, and we were beginning to broadcast live on that day. I was broadcasting on radio only on November the 22nd. I was broadcasting from the corner of Main and Akron in downtown Dallas. And I was delighted to see that there were no demonstrations, no adverse placards in evidence in downtown Dallas. Instead, it was really a warm welcome from the entire citizenry of the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and I was delighted to see it. There was red, white, and blue bunting all up and down Main Street on the motorcade route. The citizens had turned out in mass. They filled the sidewalks on both sides of the street and shouted and cheered as the motorcade passed down Main Street where I stood. I was delighted. I broadcast what a beautiful scene it was. It even seemed as though the weather had cooperated. The day in Dallas that day had dawned gray and cold, as it often did in late November. And somehow, however, there had been mist that morning, a little bit of rain, and about mid-morning, the skies opened up, cleared up. It was a blue, beautiful, sunshiny day, and it was a beautiful day for the motorcade and the welcome in downtown Dallas. Sadly, when the motorcade passed my station at the corner of Main and Ackard, I broadcast how beautiful the welcome had been, and then I began to give a wrap-up of why the president had come for his junket through Texas on those days in late November 63. He had, of course, come to drum up support from the citizens of Texas, and he was definitely having great success at that. I also was pointing out in my political wrap-up that I was doing on radio, once the motorcade passed where I was, I went on stretching my broadcast toward the time when my boss, our news director, Eddie Barker, would take over from the Trademark, where the president was to deliver his noon address, which, of course, never took place. I was still talking about the fact that the president had come to Texas to reunite the warring Texas Democrats, who were divided in those days between the conservative Texas Democrats, and their leader was primarily Lyndon Johnson. And on the other side, the liberal wing of the Democrats, whose de facto leader was our Texas United States Senator, Ralph Yarborough, a great old, good and honest East Texas populist politician, whose motto was, "You always put the jam on the lower shelves so the little people can get to it."
Yeah.
And I always appreciated that in Senator Yarborough. And I was going on giving that political wrap-up while the president was being assassinated barely more than 1,000 yards away from me. I, of course, didn't know that. And when I got my mobile unit, a little station wagon, I got it back to our newsroom. Our 10 o'clock newscaster, Warren Foulkes, came running out and told me the president has been shot and taken to Parkland. So I told him to grab a camera and let's go. We used 16-millimeter black and white film to cover the news back then, and we were just beginning on that very day to muster our mobile television vans to be able to bring news from on the spot as we had never done to cover the news before that day. So I took us to Parkland Hospital in that little Mercury Comet faster than it had been designed to travel. And I got there just shortly after the entire complex of the hospital had been cordoned off. I knew I had to have the mobile unit with me or I could not broadcast, so knowing that the Secret Service and Dallas police were watching me, and I was hoping that they would not shoot, I drove that little wagon around their barricades, and I waved to them, jumped that car over the curb, and then jumped medians all the way across the Parkland parking lot until I was with about 150 feet or so from the emergency entrance. And there they stopped me for good, and I broadcast from there the saddest scene that I have ever had to witness and broadcast. The dignitaries who had been in the motorcade were unable inside the hospital because of security considerations, and instead they were standing outside in the area outside of the emergency entrance in shock. They were just milling around, good and small conversation groups, speaking in hushed tones, and I questioned them as gently as I could because I knew that some of them had seen things that they had preferred not to see. When I asked Senator Yarbrough what he had seen, he burst into tears. And I asked Congressman Ray Roberts. He said, "I just can't tell you anything. I just can't think straight." And that was the way it was with most of those legislators who had been president in the president's party. And in the meantime, my colleague, Warren Foulkes, and I traded off on the microphone. One of us would try to get as much information as we could while the other was broadcasting. And we knew we had to stay on the air and assure our listeners that we were there to tell them what was happening. And we summarized often to explain what had taken place, that the president and the governor had been cut down by Esten's bullets downtown Dallas. So I went on that day, and ultimately de facto press secretary for that trip with the president, Malcolm Kilduff, set up a de facto press room on the first floor of the hospital where we began to get some of our information through his briefings. I had reported on one of my very first reports that two priests had brushed past me on their way toward the trauma room where the president was. I did not speculate on why they were coming, but I feared the worst. And we went on broadcasting that day, sometimes not knowing very much information, but giving a summary of what we did have. And at that time, we were all wondering and hoping that the president would live. That was not to be. And at the time that I found out, even before I knew the president was dead, I had managed to get Congressman Jim Wright, a wonderful man who had begun his political career as the mayor of Weatherford, Texas. And he was the Fort Worth congressman, a Democrat, who later became Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. He was a great House Speaker, and he was a great man. He's still alive today, I'm happy to report. And I had managed to get Congressman Wright over to my mobile unit, where I was about to ask him questions about what he had seen. But in the few minutes before we were about to go on the air, my two-way radio in my little mobile unit told us that the president was dead. At that moment, I did not feel like speaking. I felt like weeping instead. And so I said to Congressman Wright, "I know that no one wants to speak at a time like this, but do you have anything you could say?" And I held the button down on my little two-way microphone so that he could broadcast live on KRLD, AM, and FM. Congressman Wright bowed his head and gave the most statesmanlike, prayerful wishes that I could have dreamed of, standing alone with me beside our mobile unit there in the Parkland parking lot. it was a sad day, and we both said so. In his remarks, Jim Wright prayed for comfort to President Kennedy's widow and his children and his family, and comfort to the family of Governor Connally, whose prognosis at that time was uncertain. We stood in silence. We were standing among a crowd of hundreds of people who had simply come walking in to the Parkland parking lot area where the Secret Service were keeping them at a distance. They kept us all at a slight distance from the doors into the emergency entrance at the back of the hospital. And this was a silent crowd. Many of these were Dallasites who had been in that beautiful, welcoming crowd downtown as the motorcade came through. And I stood in silence with them in vigil for our president outside Parkland Hospital on that day, which had become a beautiful, spring-like, sunshiny day. The crowd was silent. Many of them held their children's hands. It was a tribute. It was a tribute in silence as much as it had been a cheering tribute at the motorcade downtown. And after a short period of time, the police finally began to move the crowd back after we had learned that the president was dead. It was not too long after that until the police moved me back at a greater distance from the ER entrance, and I suspected what was about to happen. I couldn't see the emergency room entrance from the new location where they had moved me. And I stood in silence with the crowd, and I reported what I saw. I saw two motorcycles with their red lights flashing come around from behind the hospital. I reported that they were followed by a white hearse. I did not report that the president's body was aboard that hearse, although I suspected that it was. I did not report that his widow, still stained with her husband's blood, was a passenger in that hearse, but she was. I reported that the hearse had departed, and I reported that the story there was over for me, and I said that this is the most silent crowd that will ever assemble, because this was the day when the President of the United States was killed by an assassin's bullet before our very eyes in Dallas, Texas.
A stunning thing. You know, I remember, you know, of course, as a child, but everybody else felt, my first reaction as a schoolboy was, well, that's stupid. Don't you know? He's right here in Texas. And I had the same attitude that, hey, he's in Texas. We're giving him a Texas welcome. And to think that this happened to him, and for many people for a long period of time, it stained the city of Dallas, stained the state of Texas. People looked at us with this horrible eye. The president, President Kennedy, had just passed by. He was a few blocks down. I understand the Dealey Plaza area where you see that famous Zapruder film. The parade, the motorcade, was essentially over with about that. That was just the last little bit, and he was going to go on to the trademark from there. And that's when it happened. So most everybody did get a chance to see him before it happened. And then those the pathetic little punk shot him. And you know, it's so hard to believe this war hero, this handsome man, a man who had done some really incredible things as president, you know, averted nuclear war, began promoting civil rights, and, you know, a really good, you know, man with flaws, but a lot of good things about him, and this pathetic, really creepy guy gets international notoriety for murdering him. And William Manchester said, you know, to take the president being murdered by such a wretch as him was very hard for people to comprehend and settle in their minds. Just a very difficult thing. And, of course, I'm leading to 2 days later, you saw this this wretched human being. Who knows why in the world the Dallas police handled it the way they did, but you had a friend, Mr. Lavelle, who was the famous fellow in the a light-colored suit escorting him out there, and you were standing there just holding the mic for sound, and lo and behold, Jack Ruby said, I should have just sent that letter and stepped out and shot him to death. So in a period of 2 days, you saw two men get murdered before your very eyes in one of the most stunning things that has ever happened. I don't know if there's ever been a murder live on television. It was really horrifying.
No, in fact, Frank, that was television's very first murder. And it was a dubious distinction for me to be one of the two reporters who broadcast it live. The other was Tom Pettit for NBC, and of course I did it for CBS. And when you say before our very eyes, actually the Oswald murder was before my very eyes, but when I used that expression about the president's death, of course I was being, that was a figurative statement. There were people who saw it before their very eyes, but I was not one of them, since I was still at Main and Ackard, still broadcasting.
And did you hear the shots or anything? Or
no, I didn't. I was 11,000 feet away, and I was still reporting. So the reason I know that's how far I was a little more than 11,000 feet, and the reason I know that is that they measured that distance when they were trying to determine whether or not they could use any kind of audio processing to pick out sounds of the shots that might have been on my broadcast tape. Mm-hmm. They were unable to do that, by the way, mm-hmm. and I don't think they'll ever retrieve the shots from my old audio from that day. Mm-hmm. So we knew that that Oswald would have to be transferred from police headquarters to the sheriff's custody at county headquarters, because this was not a federal crime back in 1963. It was a Texas murder case, and so it was going to be handled under Texas law, which required that once the charge that great was filed, then he would be transferred to the custody of the county, where he would then receive a trial. Of course, that was never to be. And the way that Ruby got down into the basement, I'll tell you this. I had worked as a police officer in Bryan, not too far from where you are now, and I knew that no police officer would have wanted to make that transfer public, and I can tell you that not one member of the Dallas Police Department wanted it to be public. From the chief on down, they all opposed that, but because of the embarrassing incidents that had taken place in the city and given the city a mixed reputation already, the Dallas mayor, Earl Campbell, and other city fathers, and they were city fathers back then and not mothers, they had decided that in order to make sure that the city didn't suffer any more bad reputation, that they would order the police to make it a public transfer in order to placate the out-of-town press. We in Dallas, we reporters who worked in Dallas, had such a good relationship with the police that it was quite unusual. Even for those times, we got along with the police a lot better than most metropolitan reporters got along with their police officers. And so the police were being very cooperative, but even so, the mayor and other powerful folks in town prevailed upon the police, actually forced them to make it a public transfer. And Chief Curry would regret that until his dying day. So would the rest of the police officers who still survive today. Officer Jim Lavelle, who was handcuffed to Oswald, handcuffed himself to the prisoner because, as he told me, well, there had been threats come in to the sheriff's office and police threatening to take our prisoner away from us. So I handcuffed myself to him because I wasn't going to go. Jim Lavelle is using a walker these days, but he still looks great and is a good friend of mine. And the last time I saw him was just a few weeks ago. I told him he still looked like he could take me, and he laughed because he was quite a man and still is. I was not going to speak, as you pointed out, Frank. We were working with CBS in New York, of course, to coordinate our broadcast out of Dallas. And in New York, they told us they wanted to simply pick the transfer up on videotape and rerun it at their convenience during their series of broadcasts that they were doing that day. NBC, Tom Pettit was broadcasting for NBC in the basement that day, and they planned to take the transfer live, which they did. So they were already on the air when the shot was fired, but they didn't pick me up until just a split second or two after the shot was fired and after I had said twice, Oswald has been shot. I did not shout it, as has been reported in print sometimes. I just said, Oswald has been shot, in that tone of voice, twice. And I was talking as much to my colleague, Nelson Benton of CBS, as I was to our listeners and viewers, because I had a live mic down in the basement, and Nelson was up in our van preparing to narrate the entire transfer while looking at our three monitors to show what camera shot we had up at the time. It took me a while down there in the basement to realize that he couldn't possibly know from up in our van on the street outside that Oswald had been shot and what was happening down there. It took me a while to realize I had hesitated to speak at first because I was afraid I might be covering anything that Nelson was saying. And Nelson was hesitating to speak because he was afraid he was covering me. So both of us were stuck on national television live audio, and neither of us could hear the other, and neither of us for a time dared speak. So at last I concluded that there's no way he could know. So I then finally turned around, faced the camera, and began to report. I reported that Oswald had been shot by a man wearing a black hat and a coat. I was unable to say very much more than that because I had not seen Ruby clearly, and I didn't know Ruby at the time anyway. A lot of the reporters did, and they hated to see Jack Ruby coming because he was a pest. He was a police and media groupie. That's what Jack Ruby's life was like. He ran a strip club, you know, in downtown Dallas, the Carousel, and another club out in the Cedar Springs area where they didn't take it all off. And he was a little fellow who was always determined to be part of the action. He wanted to be a reporter, and he wanted to be a cop. He told the police immediately after he shot Oswald, "I did it because you couldn't." He thought he would be a hero. Not anything like that. Ruby was actually so devoid of good sense that he was surprised to discover that he was no hero to the police. He was a pain in the ass. And that is sort of the way Jack Ruby was. The way he got down into the basement was unfortunate, but it was a convergence of circumstances, as was so much that happened in those few days. Jack Ruby was totally unaware on that Sunday when he shot Oswald. He was unaware that he might have had to sneak in to police headquarters. He had been accustomed to walking in anytime he wanted to. And in fact, on the night of the assassination, two nights before, he had been in police headquarters and had been present when the police brought Oswald out to show him to the out-of-town press to prove that they were not abusing their prisoner. The out-of-town press suspected the Dallas police because they had already by then seen a lot of the police brutality that was being used against peaceful demonstrators for civil rights across the American South. And that is why a lot of the out-of-town reporters were so suspicious of the Dallas police, not realizing that they were actually a very professional group of law enforcement people who were anything but the stereotypes of the Bull Connor sheriffs across the American South. It was a sad sight. But nonetheless, the Dallas police suffered for it because they were shouted at by reporters, and they had brought Oswald out to try to show the press that they were not abusing their prisoner. So when they agreed reluctantly and much against their will to make this a public transfer, they were doing their best to safeguard the prisoner. And although the security at police headquarters had not been tight on the previous 2 days, it was very tight on that Sunday when Oswald was finally shot. My best police contact, Sergeant Patrick Dean, was in charge of security in the basement that day. And he had the entire basement emptied of all reporters and everyone else, me included. And then we were allowed to come back in only by showing our identifications and passing through clearance to get back into the basement. So everyone who was in place down there in the basement had already been checked out, but not Ruby. And that was a different sort of thing. Ruby was not down there until the last minute before Oswald was shot. And very few people have realized this over the years. And it took me decades to be able to prove for my own satisfaction exactly how Ruby had gotten into the basement. Ruby had gotten up that morning at about, he took his time getting up. Remember, this was a guy who, first of all, was not quite playing with a full deck. And he was also hooked on two kinds of speed, Benzedrine and Preludin. He was not sleeping very much at all. And he was already wired enough, as it was, without the speed. But Ruby was wired on Preludin and Benzedrine. And it's not too surprising that a person in that situation would be impulsive enough to shoot the most hated prisoner in modern American history. We all knew that Oswald was such a hated person by then. And the previous day, I had commented to my colleague Nelson Benton that all of our stations had had bomb threats and other crank calls, and we had realized that we were at the epicenter of a dangerous and crazy situation. I looked at the elevators on the third floor disgorging passengers and said to Nelson, what if somebody just stepped out of one of those elevators and started raking us with a Tommy gun? Nelson said, nothing. We just looked at each other and got up and moved. And we stayed in safe angles after that and tried to make sure that our camera crews were in safe position. So on that Sunday morning, when we knew that Oswald would be transferred, we never knew exactly when the transfer would take place, but the chief had told us that if we were set up to do television by 10 a.m., that it would be soon enough to take the transfer. But even the police didn't know exactly when it would take place because they were waiting for the Secret Service chief, Forrest Sorrells, to finish questioning Oswald that morning. So Ruby got up, not knowing that he might have to sneak in if he wanted to get into police headquarters that day. But Ruby's thing was he always wanted to be part of what was going on, whatever it was. So when one of his strippers, little Lynn, called him from Fort Worth asking for $25 to pay her rent, he told her, well, I'm going downtown anyway. I'll just wire it to you from the Western Union office. So Ruby had taken his time that morning. He didn't know about the transfer. He had no special information about it. And nobody in his right mind would have ever chosen this strange little slightly crazy man to be part of a conspiracy, because Ruby talked all the time. He wanted to say everything. Later on, in an interview I did with him far later, Ruby advanced to me his own conspiracy theories. So he was that nutty. He thought there was a conspiracy. He was certainly not part of one. So he told little Lynn he would wire her her money. And later that morning, he took his time. He got dressed, took a shower, fixed himself breakfast, and then he took his dog, Sheba, a dachshund, whom he called his wife, jokingly. He had a male roommate. He was in his 50s, Ruby was. And he took his dog, Sheba, and put her in his car. I don't think I would have taken my dog if I had been going to murder someone. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Jack Ruby was planning on doing anything like that, even though he had said something the day or two before to his sister by telephone about wanting to kill that guy. But nonetheless, he was not planning it, certainly. He never suspected that he would have such an opportunity.
Well, did he? I mean, I wouldn't think of bringing a loaded weapon to my police station. He just walked in there with a, did he always carry a firearm or something?
He was known to carry a pistol. Usually he carried a little Colt Cobra, like one I had carried when I worked with the Bryan Police Department down there. And everybody knew that Jack Ruby often carried a gun. He carried a lot of cash from his strip club and his other club, so that was his ostensible reason for carrying that little pistol. And he was carrying it that day, and that was not particularly unusual. I'm sure that most of the police were aware that Ruby often was armed, but no one knew that he was in the station. And he got in by a total coincidence. And here's how it took place. That morning, Police Chief Curry had ordered an armored truck to move Oswald because there had been a very credible threat that previous night of a coordinated attack on whatever vehicle would be carrying Oswald in the transfer. So the police took that very seriously, and that's why Chief Curry ordered the armored truck. But Captain Will Fritz, who had been busy those 2 days questioning Oswald, had been disgusted at the very idea of a public transfer, and he had pretty much disassociated himself from it while he was busy questioning Oswald. But on that morning, when the transfer would take place, Fritz said that he felt the armored truck would be a slow-moving vehicle that would be vulnerable to attack, and he didn't want Oswald to be aboard that vulnerable armored truck. So they had decided to use the truck only as a decoy, and they hadn't told even Sergeant Dean and people like that who were familiar with what was happening. So they had kept that quite secret. And at the very last minute, they decided that they needed more armed officers to guard the armored truck because it would be vulnerable even as a decoy, and they didn't want it attacked. They were going to take Oswald in an unmarked car. And it was all being, it had been decided at the last few minutes. And then the moving of a car at the very last minute happened literally at the last minute before Oswald was shot. I have timed all of this with a stopwatch many times all those years ago because it was my job to take all the law enforcement personnel who came by to see those tapes. I would take them, and with a stopwatch, I would point out what was happening. I know that it was exactly 50 seconds before the shot was fired that the police moved an unmarked car out of the down ramp and out of the in entrance ramp to Main Street to take that car around and escort the armored truck with it, with three more armed officers. That all took place at the very last minute, and the armored truck was in place blocking the exit ramp, so they couldn't take that car out with the truck. Instead, they took it out the down ramp. And Officer Roy Vaughn, who had been assigned to guard that entrance, made a mistake that day. He stepped out from that entrance to direct traffic for that departing car. And it was then that Jack Ruby just simply walked in. Ruby had stopped at the Western Union office, which was at the opposite end of the same block the police station was in. He had sent that telegram, and all Western Union telegrams of the day were stamped with Naval Observatory time, which showed up on little Lynn's telegram with her $25 as exactly 11:17 a.m. It was not, those telegrams were not timed to the second, only to the minute. And my CBS videotapes showed me that the shot was fired at exactly 11:21. So if you do the math, you'll realize that Ruby, after he had sent that telegram, had between 3 and 4 minutes to walk down the block and in the open basement entrance to the ramp, the vehicle ramp coming down into the basement. He was able to do that when that car was being moved out in a big hurry. And Ruby later, when my friend Sergeant Patrick Dean asked him how he got down there, he said, "Oh, I just walked in when Sam Pierce drove out." Ruby even recognized the driver of the car and called him by his nickname. He was actually Lieutenant Rio Pierce, but his nickname was Sam, and Ruby knew that. And he had to have seen who was driving that car, or he would not have been able to say that immediately after he had shot Oswald. So I know that Jack Ruby was telling the truth when he said he came in when that car came out. And my stopwatch told me time and again that the time that lapsed between the departure of that car and the shot was exactly 50 seconds. So I know that Ruby was telling the truth. The films, some of the photography that was being taken that morning, show that Jack Ruby had walked down into the basement. He had sunglasses on at first, and he stepped in beside my film cameraman, George Phoenix, who was just standing to my right, and Ruby stood beside George, and he had only stood there for, you know, less than a minute when Oswald was brought out, and Ruby, whatever his plans might have been, they had not been specifically planning murder. But at that moment, Ruby, hot-headed, wired on speed, jumped out with that little Colt Cobra and fired one .38 slug into Oswald's lower abdomen. I had seen people shot with several .38 shots, one of whom who had beaten the devil out of the guy who had shot him. And .38s are not a high-caliber weapon, and I didn't expect that Oswald would die, nor did anyone else. But as it happened, Oswald had been turned sideways when the shot hit him, so it traversed his lower abdominal cavity from one side to the other, and it clipped the two primary blood vessels there. The aorta, the main vein going, the main artery going into the heart, and the inferior vena cava, the main vein coming out of the heart. Coming out of the heart. I said that wrong. The aorta was the artery coming out of the heart. The vein, the vena cava, goes into the heart.
Right, right. Okay.
So it was as though he had shot the man in the heart. He might as well have, because Oswald died quite rapidly of hemorrhagic shock. He had lost so much blood. He had bled a great deal internally. And Officer Jim Lavelle, who was handcuffed to him, had jumped into the ambulance with his prisoner and followed him all the way until he was pronounced dead. In the trauma room, the doctors who had worked on the president two days before were working on the man who had killed the president. And they were unable to save Oswald either because of the excessive bleeding. And the shot that had traversed his lower abdomen had lodged just under the skin and was quite visible on the other side of his body. It had slowed all the way until it was stopped by his skin on the other side. So after the doctors had pronounced him dead, one of them took his scalpel and popped that little slug out and handed it to Officer Jim Lavelle, who turned it over, scratched a mark on it, and then got the nurse and a few other people to identify and notify, you know, that particular slug, so that they would be able to testify that that was indeed the slug that had been inside the body of Lee Harvey Oswald. And Ruby, in the meantime, while Oswald was dying, was up in the jail. I had interviewed Officer Dean after the ambulance departed, and I asked him as much as I could on national television, knowing that a good policeman would never be able to tell me the name of the shooter. Otherwise, we would end up realizing in court that that would be grounds for a change of venue at the very least.
Yeah.
At that time, we didn't even know that Oswald would be dead. So I was careful as I questioned Officer Patrick Dean, my sergeant friend, because we were in uncharted territory. I had never, you know, there had never been a nationally televised shooting before that moment. And I knew that this police officer would not be able to tell me who the shooter was, even if he knew. And I suspected pretty early on that Pat did know who had fired the shot because he had helped subdue Ruby. And I asked him everything I could except Ruby's name that morning. And I didn't ask him the name because I knew he could not answer. I asked him everything I could. He said that the man was a Dallas businessman. And he said, I do know the man. And if I had seen him down here, I would have ejected him.
Okay. You did not hear at the moment that some cop shouted out, Jack, you son of a bitch. I mean,
that was Pat. He said, Jack, you son of a bitch. And later he said, you know, you've got me in a heck of a mess. The police were furious at Jack.
Yeah.
And Jack was so strange and so really not intelligent. And he was a lot of things, but intelligent he was not. And so he was surprised that he was not a hero. He had made his police friends quite angry.
But he just did it at the top. He just happened to be there at that moment. He saw him, got really ticked off, and pulled out his firearm and shot him.
That's right.
No great mystery, no Oliver Stone weaving in and out. This guy's related to this guy, and this guy's connected to that guy and everything. There's a lot of talk about, still today, the conspiracy theories, and I keep on thinking, by now, somebody would have figured it all out, and there would have been some people brought to justice. You can't involve
and
that.
Oliver Stone, I will say this, Frank, Oliver Stone has done more than any other single person to muddy up the historical record here. I had thought that he, by now, would have abandoned some of his really disgustingly simple and misguided conspiracy theories, but he has not. He's still talking about a conspiracy, claiming that there was another shooter in addition to Oswald, etc. And so he's just going on about it. And the movie JFK has done us a great disservice because it has portrayed Jim Garrison as a sane man, and he was not that.
Kevin Costner
was a very sympathetic Jim Garrison.
Yeah.
But Jim Garrison was not sympathetic. Frank, I'm going to have to leave. I've got another interview who's at the door.
Well, by golly, Bob, this has been great. It's been fascinating. I hope you're feeling well after all that's going on with you, but I've been delighted you spent so much time with me, and I thank you so much, and we'll get together again sometime. Call anytime, okay?
Okay, Frank. You take care.
All right.
Thanks a million.
All right.
Hang in there.
I will.